That's Jim Cole. That's the guy that James Taylor does his best to imitate. A lamp unto my feet from Jim Cole. We heard two from Carolyn Aaron's Not a Tame Lion. And good morning to you. 9.5 minutes past the hour. It's a Wednesday morning, and we're joined from Columbia, Maryland by Doug Greenwald, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. Doug, how are you? Good morning.
Well, I'm doing fine, guys. Good to be back. Good to have you all back.
Well, yeah, it was a real change. I hadn't taken a vacation in, I can't tell you how many years, but a whole week off. I'm kind of slow getting back to the routine here.
But, so what did you do? Go north and break the ice in the Minnesota lakes?
No, actually, we went west and escaped the whole shebang here. Drove out to Missoula, 1,104 miles from where we are here in East Dakota, and some spectacular landscapes and weather. I mean, it's big sky country for a reason. And you could see these thunderstorms. Coming back, headed back home east, we had a thunderstorm behind us, and then farther back behind the thunderstorm was a bright red sunset. I've never seen such a sight as a bright red thunderstorm with that red sun shining through the rain and the thunder clouds. It was just an awesome sight. See things I haven't seen anywhere else.
And that's where the buffalo roam.
That's where the buffalo still roam there too. And the antelope and a whole bunch of beef cattle. In fact, we found ourselves trying to driving along through these large, huge ranches on either side, cattle ranches, and trying to identify the breeds that we saw. And I'm duty bound this week to look up the kind of cattle that we eat. I mean, I ate one of those. That's an Angus. I recognize that one. But some of the other, I did see a Texas Longhorn for the first time. Had at least several of those in one small cluster of bovines on one of the cattle ranches. So, yeah, it was a fascinating trip. And you know, we've been warned beforehand that, oh, that's boring. That road is just so boring. You take a book or something, or an audio book. But we didn't need it. We were so transfixed by the landscape. And something called, have you ever heard of the Painted Canyon in western North Dakota?
No, I heard the Painted Desert.
Well, I've heard there's a Painted Desert, and there's, of course, the Grand Canyon and Bryce Canyon and other canyons. This is kind of like a miniature Grand Canyon in a way. The amazing formations in the rocks for miles. It's in a place called the Theodore Roosevelt National Park. Hmm. And it's on the east side of Montana, almost out of North Dakota. But the thousands of acres of these wild hills with the striations of color and formation and green grass in between, a gorgeous place. That's where Theodore Roosevelt went and became a cowboy back in the 1890s, early 1890s. And that's where he got his taste for conservation and began the National Parks Movement, inspired by that particular area. We had no idea it was there. I'd never heard of it. And all of a sudden, we're driving through it, and we're just stunned by the scenery. So, no, it was a wonderful trip. And you had a trip of your own, didn't you? You went to the beach with your granddaughter.
We did. We went to the beaches of Sanibel and Captiva off Fort Myers in southwestern Florida.
Now, this is kind of a family tradition with you, isn't it?
We do. It's whenever a grandchild graduates or leaves elementary school, they get their choice of any destination for a week in the United States.
And really?
So we've got, in a few more years, we have two twins coming along. So we're kind of intrigued. Will they decide to do the same thing together? Will they want to do different things?
Well, that,
one go east
problem,
and one go west?
is it too late to get adopted?
Well, what's your pedigree?
Like, oh, you want to know about my background? Oh, no. Okay, well, never mind.
We do not have reciprocity with the state of East Dakota these days.
Well, listen, we would show you the sights in East Dakota if you were to head.
But you know, Jim, as you described your journey, I had a couple of flashbacks. But one of them was when I drove from Denver to Ellsworth, Kansas, 300 miles across the eastern Colorado and western Kansas, flatter than a pancake.
Mm-hmm.
And every 7 to 10 miles was another grain elevator and another, you know, town of 1,000 people. And a really violent thunderstorm came across Kansas. And what was fascinating to me is you could see the beginning of it and the end of it, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas when you live around trees and, you know, hilly hills give you an undulated landscape, it's so much harder to get a perspective on that. And then the second wanderlust was I've had a fantasy for a long time. I'll probably die with it, but just to get in a small RV and just hit the road in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, fine, see the great national parks, but do exactly what you're talking about. Just drive across Montana.
Yeah.
Stop and see Pella, Iowa, or Amana, Iowa. I mean, never been there. Have no idea what that's like, you mm-hmm. know, just mm-hmm. to take it in. And just do that for 6 or 8 weeks at a time. Come back home, or, you know, reload, wash the clothes,
yep.
Service the rig, and hit the road again. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I think there's so many things to appreciate in the second and tertiary tier of what we call the big national sites in America that are would still take your breath away.
Well, the other thing I was reminded of is just how large this country is. Yeah, it was 1,100 miles, but we knew that going in. It's a fairly long two-day drive, but it was worth every... Now, David reminded me, thank you, David, mm-hmm, that if you're driving that road for the fifth or sixth time, it's not quite as exciting.
No.
That may be the case. But well, there was a Continental Divide. It was about 6,300 feet up on the top of the Continental Divide in Montana, and then you head down toward Missoula as you get to the western end of the state. I mean, there were lots of things to see, and Missoula is a wonderful city, university town. It's one of the few cities I've seen with a thriving downtown area. It's an older downtown with a lot of the old traditional buildings along with some of the new. Architecturally, it's not really interesting, but it's just crawling with people having a good time and ducking in and out of these cute little restaurants and shops, and it's constantly busy. I'm assured it's that way year-round. And kind of a cosmopolitan little place with all the university influence there. So, yeah, we enjoyed it. It was a special trip.
Back in my semi-misspent youth, a friend of mine and I finished our 2 years of community college, or two-year college. And notice I said finished as opposed to graduated.
Well, yeah.
But we joined the military together, and then we took the month of September or August, and because we went in October, rather. One of those months. Anyway, 30-day period, we put our tent and our sleeping bags in my 59 Rambler and drove out west and took a tour of all the great state and national parks.
Hmm.
And lived off the land, and, you know, and it had saved up some money, so we weren't panhandling. But yeah. What a memorable month.
Every young person should do that.
I was 19 or 20, and just, you know, free as a bird, and had my future set out, but just incredible sights.
You had a 59 Rambler?
I did.
Do you know what that would be worth today?
A lot more than I paid for it. Well,
at least 79 cents, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Actually, driving a 59 Rambler explains a lot of things about David, doesn't it?
It does. new insights I'm gaining here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that, you know, you evoke another memory here. When I finally got out of school in the late 60s, my wife and I, we'd been married for 2 years, sold everything we had, which wasn't much. We'd been just married for 2 years. Mostly we sold her 64 Mustang.
Oh. Uh-oh.
And, bought a VW camper for pickup in London. Bought two round-trip tickets from Detroit Metropolitan Airport to Gatwick for $203. Mm. And we spent 100 days just banging around Europe in our VW camper.
Mm-hmm.
And... we didn't even spend $1,500 for that total trip once we hit the ground for maintenance, campsites, foods, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow.
That's when you could get a Deutsches beefsteak dinner for 5 marks then, mm-hmm. which was $1.25.
Mm.
And traveled 15,000 miles all through Europe.
15,000.
Often, I've had a yearning. I wish I could do the same thing in the States, just get in a little camper and hit the road. But... I think that's mostly a memory lane kind of fantasy these days. But
well, certainly the cost of travel.
Yeah, you mentioned hitting the road and traveling. It does evoke many, many pleasant memories.
Well, I think people should take every opportunity they have, or manufacture opportunities to do that. And you know, I guess that's why there are vacations. And a lot of us don't take regular vacations. It's not like we work for a company that says, here's 2 weeks, we'll pay you and just go away. That doesn't happen for everybody. But it takes a certain amount of discipline to impose a vacation on yourself, and it's usually wisdom. It's a wise thing to do, to break the routine and go see something different and come back refreshed. That happened to me last week, so I'm really grateful for the safe travel and the astounding scenery that we saw.
So, well, how appropriate that the host of Broken Road Radio hits the road for 1,100 miles
yeah. Each way. Yeah.
The John D. McDonald, the mystery writer, 60s, 70s, and 80s, right in there, and I think he died in the late 80s sometime. His main character, Travis McGee, was a guy who lived aboard a houseboat, 45-foot-long houseboat. And he would do detective work or recovery work or insurance work or some kind of work, you know, usually involved, you know, Don Quixote kind of things where he'd ride in and save the distressed maiden but make some money in the process. And he always, his philosophy was he would watch the bank account, and when he got down to a certain month, then he would go out and look for work again or a certain amount of money in the mm-hmm. bank, because he said, I'm taking my vacation and my retirement as I go. And retirement is way too precious to waste on old people. You got to take it along when you have the time and the money and the opportunity, as opposed to wait until you're done with some, you know, some imaginary career that says, mm-hmm. okay, it's done now. I guess I can sit in my rocking chair.
Mm-hmm.
I've always liked that philosophy that you take your, you smell your roses when you get your time.
Well, here's the thought
yep.
for you two. Maybe once a week, you have a little spot on your radio where you interview someone, and the theme is the best road trip I've ever taken.
Oh, wow. Well,
so fitting for stories. Broken Road Radio.
Yeah.
Well, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, by email, people can nominate the road trip that, like let's say somebody went from St. Louis to Amarillo on Route 66, you know, mm-hmm. what was yeah. that like?
Yeah.
And just invite people to share the best road trip they've ever taken.
I think that would be fascinating. That would be good yeah. if we can get some people to volunteer their time and do that and join us here on the radio. Yeah, good idea, Doug. Good idea.
Yeah.
Well, we've been on the road to Sychar. Isn't that how you say the village? In Samaria? Sychar?
Oh, Sychar?
Sychar? Okay, yeah. We've been on the road there for a long time, Doug.
Well, yeah, and actually, I'm getting sidetracked from the road to Sychar
that's easy
these days because I keep processing our trip to Italy and Paul's Roman World. Mm. And the thought I've been working on here lately, or another thought, has to do with a subject that we've touched on a bit previously. And that is the whole understanding of what a Roman slave was like in the first century in the Roman world, which is the imagery that Paul draws upon in Ephesians 6 when he talks about the vision that Paul has as to what he wants people, these new believers, these new pagan Roman believers who have now become followers of Jesus Christ, to see as their new identity in Christ. And he says, you need to see yourself, I exhort you to see yourself as a slave of Christ. And the Greek word there is doulos, D-U-L-O-S. And so, obviously, Paul is drawing upon the context of what it meant to be a Roman slave in the first century. Well, now I want to fast forward. That word doulos stayed in the early manuscripts of the church up until about the 1500s. And then in the Geneva Bible, it was translated servant. And shortly thereafter, the King James, which became the most popular Bible for a long, long time, came to the word doulos, the translation team did, and said, because of the context of the word slavery, what it meant in evoking the English, the British slave trade business, said, we cannot use this word. So they translated servant of Christ instead of slave of Christ, and really diluted the meaning and the weight of what Paul was trying to communicate there. That understanding of servant of Christ continued on for probably 350 years. Then as we get midway through the 20th century, you know, in the 1950s, Western translators are catching up to this, and they now are more and more putting the word doulos as slave back into the text, its original meaning, and deleting the word servant. But interestingly enough, in 1975, when the New King James Version came out, it only tweaked it a little bit, and I think did an injustice to the text, to the Pauline text. They took the word servant and made it bond servant, but they didn't make it slave or bond slave. And so as most of the Bibles began to get the translation right and put the word slave back in the text in the mid-1950s, that also coincided with the birth and the gradual momentum of the American Civil Rights Movement. And so no one wanted to really focus on the word slave with that whole cultural backdrop of the Civil Rights Movement going on in America. And so pastors avoided that text like the plague. And no one dealt with that subject. And so now it's been almost 400 years in what John MacArthur calls the great cover-up. Paul's vision for our identity in Christ has been covered up for that long, diluted down, put into soft focus. We've been given the word servant, which is just a shadow of what Paul meant with the word doulos. So I've been writing to try to then now recreate the whole slave context of the first century so that we can catch up to, so to speak, or recapture the vision. I think the title I'm using it for right now, Reclaiming Our Kingdom Identity, which has been lost for 400 years. And that is the incredibly high calling of seeing ourselves as a slave of Christ, understanding what the first century slave world was all about in the Roman Empire. So that's part of what I'm thinking on right now. But just in the last week or so, I'm doing some more work. And I read that one of the, and I've mentioned this before, one of the geniuses of the Roman world is it gave aspirational hope to Roman slaves, and that is their masters, at least those in the city masters, not the rural masters, would encourage many of their slaves to go into business, to be entrepreneurs, to earn money, to, with the master's consent, buy their freedom. And when they became free, it was a process called manumission, they became a freedman or freedman, which is the technical term in that culture. And at that moment in time, I just discovered, this is the part I just discovered, your master now became your patron. Hmm. And there's a whole patronage ambiance in the Roman world in the first century that actually starts to shape the early Christians' understanding of grace. And actually the historic church has picked this notion up with their patron saints. Mm-hmm. And so your patron is one who looks out for you. And that is remarkable in this Roman context, because in this pantheism of God, this portfolio of major gods, minor gods, household gods, and cultic gods, here's, I think, a point we often miss. The gods are not for you. And therefore, you have to appease them with your sacrifices and your incense offerings, et cetera, et cetera. Their whole view of the nature of gods is they're antagonistic to your best interest, and therefore, that's why you have to appease them. And so with this backdrop of patronage in place, it helps people understand that Jesus, God the Father, is actually someone now, like a patron, who has your best interest at heart. And patrons, you can sometimes, in this Roman world, you can sit on the bench outside the villa home of your patron, and at a certain time in the morning, you can enter the atrium and go to his office, which is called the tabulum, and you can make a request. And many times your patron will honor that request and give you a loaf of bread or a coin of money or what have you. And sometimes a patron, just in his own goodness, will unilaterally just surprise those in his patronage network with a gift. And those are all aspects of prayer and grace, which are sort of embedded in the Roman system from a conceptual point of view, what the Germans would call the Gestalt perspective. And that was part of the ambiance that helped people understand some of the basic tenets of some of the patterning that took place in their own culture. Now, this is further carried on by the Emperor Augustus, the very first emperor who decided that he was a god. And so he had Virgil write books, basically, detailing how Virgil came from the gods and to become a human being on earth as emperor. And this notion helped people understand Jesus Christ as one who came from God himself and became a human and walked this earth. So it's just fascinating to me as these cultural backdrops start to show up on the scene that will help create an understanding of some very basic tenets of the faith for these early pagan believers. And that is of someone who is fully God becomes fully man, Jesus, just like the emperor claimed he did. And also this notion of patronage, that there's actually someone now who's on your side who will help you and who will do gracious things without even asking to further your life along. And so these kind of insights, maybe they don't thrill anybody else, but I find them incredibly exciting because part of what we see here is how God is at work in a culture long before the gospel shows up to ready them to understand quickly and to adapt to some very fundamental understandings of the faith. And I hope I didn't lose you or confuse you with that explanation.
No, it's prompting all kinds of ideas, and I'm thinking now of who Paul was. Probably better read than I would have presumed, probably more the intellectual. He was a student in the Hebrew law, a student of Gamaliel. And I know he was acquainted with Greek poets. He quoted them when he was in Athens, the unknown God. And those passages in Acts 17 come from Greek poetry. He may well have been acquainted with Virgil as well.
It may well be. And when he drew upon this notion of see yourself as a slave of Christ, it's helpful to realize there that Rome conquered the world. And wherever the Roman legions went, the slave traders were right in their dust. Mm-hmm. So that whenever yet another people group was conquered, the slave traders immediately bought up the best specimens from the conquered population, from the Roman general, and whisked them off to the slave markets of the Roman world, the two largest of which were in Rome, just off the Forum. And this was new to me. The second largest slave market in the world was Ephesus.
Hmm.
And that's where Paul uses this notion of a slave of Christ. Very, very appropriate. So anyway, conquered peoples, let's say you're an engineer or a physician or a teacher, and you're a North African, and you get conquered by Rome. You now become a Roman subject, but you're not a Roman citizen. And the only way you're ever going to become a Roman citizen is if you decide to sell yourself into slavery and then hopefully get a good master who will then encourage you to become an entrepreneur, who will allow you to raise money, who will eventually allow you to purchase your own freedom and become a freedman, which means you are now a Roman citizen. And so there are many examples in the historical record of professional people in conquered parts of the Roman Empire who deliberately sold themselves into slavery that as their only pathway to become free. And that's part of what Paul is drawing upon here in this context of his imagery of a Roman slave. And it's so different, so foreign to the American Southern antebellum cotton plantation understanding of slavery, which gets evoked when we use that word. And also in the historical record, there are examples of slaves who were entrepreneurs at the encouragement of their masters, who did earn enough money to become free, whose masters said, "You could become free," who said, "I don't want to become free. I want to stay in the house. I so enjoy being treated as a member of the family, being basically, essentially treated as an adopted son, that I just want to stay in this status. I don't want to become a freed man." And that's also part of the imagery that Paul is drawing upon when he exhorts people to see ourselves as slaves of Christ. And again, such a very, very different context from our southern black plantation evoking of the word slavery. Can you imagine a slave who, once his master says, "You are free," says, "No, I want to stay here," and continue in American southern plantation slavery? So we have to totally reclaim, totally restore, refurbish our understanding of the word slave if we're ever going to get close to what Paul is saying is, this is your identity in Christ. And here's another way to think about this issue. If Paul thought that our identity in Christ, as described that way, was so crucial, what has happened to us when it's been lost for 400 years?
You're explaining your reason for being, your ministry, preserving body. This is context, is what it is.
This is what we love to do.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm writing a piece now, actually an article, and this is quiz time for you guys, okay. And then I'll seg it back into our discussion here.
Okay, David, it's your turn then.
Okay. All right.
Dinah Washington won a Grammy in 1959 for singing a blues song which was named
Stormy Weather.
Unforgettable.
What a difference a day makes.
Yes. Okay. Right. We've got it in the library. David, were trying to Google the answer, weren't you? That's not fair.
No. I should have given you 30 more seconds.
Yeah, I didn't have enough time.
But, you know, if you labor in the vineyards of contextual restoration, your theme song could equally be, "What a difference a word makes."
Yeah, well, it does.
And we saw that with the word kataluma, remember, mm-hmm. in Luke 2:7. Mm-hmm. We saw that with the Greek word iro in John 15:2. And there are many more examples that could be cited. And here's yet another one, the word doulos. We have missed its meaning for the better part of 400 years. And I'm just excited about being able to write and to try to help in a very, very small way put our focus back into place. Because think of this. I've talked to a number of Christian college professors in the last 30, 40 days about this notion of doulos slave, and they're all stunned because they said, "I've had hundreds and hundreds of college students say, I can never believe in a gospel that sanctions slavery."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah. And by extension, apartheid in South Africa. All because we had no idea what the context for the word doulos was and how Paul was using it, and we were ill-equipped to defend it and to explain it to a watching world. It almost makes you sad.
And of course, there are times in our history when Scripture was used to defend our institution, our version of slavery.
Exactly. Yeah. When we project our definition of the word onto the original definition of the world and wipe out the original meaning. Hmm.
Well, the original slave codes had a very important, at least the Virginia slave codes, I'm reading off a Wikipedia page, but the slave codes of 1705 included the idea that it was people who were imported from other nations who were not Christian. It doesn't mention where they came from. Didn't have to come from Africa or the Caribbean. And in fact, included Native Americans or Indians. And the other thing that I just ran across looking through Wikipedia is that something like 5% of the 12 million slaves in this country in the early 19th century were allowed to buy their freedom. Now, I'm wondering the process of that, if the people who had at one time owned them knew about this context as well. If they were, because they lived 200 years ago didn't mean they were stupid and not well-read. In fact, you know, I think that people earlier than us were much better read than we are, generally speaking. And I'm wondering if there was at least a minority of people in this country in the 19th century who understood this same process, who understood the meaning of doulos, who understood that there was a process where the slave could purchase his freedom and then the master became a patron.
I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. It certainly raises the issue to me. How can an American slave on a cotton plantation earn any money at all, let alone enough money to buy his freedom?
Well, some were used as servants to produce income for their slave owners. They would be blacksmiths or they would be craftsmen of various kind. They would produce stuff that would be for sale. And, of course, the master, the slave owner, would then reap the profits of that. So it's different but similar. They were not dumb, those slave owners. They used what skills the slaves brought with them. But there's another huge factor here in American slavery, and that's race. Most of the slaves, to my understanding, came from North Africa, Northwest Africa. They were black. They were seen as not quite human, or at least that was the official view, so that they could justify treating them as not quite humans. But I'm thinking in the Roman Empire days, those people were from all over, all mixed skin colors and ethnic backgrounds and languages. It was a much more cosmopolitan atmosphere, environment, ambience than was the American South.
Actually, there were 20 different, we call them people groups, speaking 12 different languages, were conquered by the Roman legions, and that comprised the Roman Empire.
So do you suppose racism at all entered into the Roman version of slavery?
I have not run across that. It doesn't mean it isn't there, but you certainly get the feeling there is incredible diversity from people from Asia Minor, from North Africa, from what we've called the Balkans, you know. And so when you have 20 different people groups speaking 12 different languages, it's much harder to pick out one or two for discrimination.
And not only that, but it was a mixed bag of talents and aptitudes and experiences, too. You mentioned accountants and teachers and engineers going into slavery with very specific and highly valuable skills. That wasn't necessarily the case with American slavery.
Not at all, and that just evokes a final observation here. When Paul talks about walk worthy of the calling to which you have been called, he is invoking a Roman slave market where the conquered slaves were put on a pedestal, and oftentimes they were naked, and they had a big placard hanging around their neck that described their attributes, their ethnicity, their skills, their abilities, their character, traits, etc., etc. And it was incumbent upon the slave trader to accurately portray exactly the essence of this slave so that the buyer knew exactly what he was getting. And if he didn't get what was on that placard, he was allowed to get his money totally refunded from the slave trader. So you have to envision a slave market there, with slaves on pedestals, with these placards hanging around the neck, describing the essence of who they are. And what Paul is saying here is, when he says, walk worthy of that which you have been called to, he says, now that you've been called to be a disciple of Jesus, you have a new placard around your neck that describes new attributes. So now, what spiritual disciplines are you proficient in? What spiritual gifts do you have? Which attributes of the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes do you often exhibit? And this is meant for public display. And so one of the things I'm working on is the notion of a Sunday morning message that develops these themes, in which I give everyone in the sanctuary a 4x6 card and ask them to fill out what would be on their placard as they walk through life publicly acknowledging that they're a follower of Jesus Christ. What attributes would they write down, just like Paul is exhorting us to do with this example of walk worthy of the high calling to which you've been given.
That's an inspiration. That would be incredibly powerful in a church sermon.
Yeah.
Well, the Lord willing and the creek don't rise. That's my tentative thinking for Baxter, First Key Free Church, on whatever that March date was.
It was March 27th, 28th, I think. Doug Greenwald in Preserving Bible Times comes to your church if you ask him. And he puts on an amazing two-day seminar called Bible Alive Weekends. There are various themes for various times of the year. There's an Advent series. There's the Passion of Christ, and other teachings. And Doug is available to do a sermon on that Sunday of that weekend, too, should your church and pastor decide that that's appropriate. And it's something I've witnessed two of them now. I'll see my third the end of next March here in our local area. And if your church has yet to get a hold of Doug and just see what this offers for you and for your congregation, you really ought to do that. And you can start with a visit to their website, preservingbibletimes.org. Get a feel for who they are and what they do. Tremendous resources there, including books for your library. And Doug will come and just, enlighten your congregation and inspire them. I can't say enough for what Doug carries with him from Preserving Bible Times. It's a powerful message that is positive in all the best ways. You should do that. And preservingbibletimes.org is the website. You can link to them from ours if you're listening on brokenroadradio.com. You'll see a Preserving Bible Times graphic over on the right-hand side of the homepage. Click on it. It'll take you there instantly. It's a beautiful website. You'll learn a lot and have a whole new resource for not only your personal study and growth, but that of your church and your congregation, too. So,
hey, can I make a final request?
Please do.
Maybe the song that sets the stage for our future talks at Wednesday at 9:10 is Dinah Washington, What a Difference a Day Makes.
Hang on, Doug. You fill here while I find that song.
Okay, we'll keep talking. The idea about American slaves buying their freedom and continuing the relationship with their previous owner as a patron is just, it's buzzing around in my head. I'm finding a couple of references to something like, at least the first half of it, that American slaves who bought their freedom. Who is the guy, the famous guy, and I can see his picture. And he lived in Massachusetts and bought his freedom. And became author.
Frederick Douglass.
Frederick Douglass. And then there's a mention of a woman by the name of Elizabeth Keckley, who bought her freedom in 1760. Mm-hmm. So there were examples but of course it wasn't the predominant
speaker. And they weren't typically field hand kinds of slaves. They usually worked for the master in the household, were butlers and waiters and property maintainers, that kind of thing.
Well, they developed skills that they could actually make money outside.
They probably exhibited skills that led them to that position to begin with, I would think so. Yeah. Well, we're all set with Dinah Washington here.
Okay.
All set with Doug Greenwald. Doug, again, a most enlightening and enjoyable morning with you. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. See you again.
Thanks,
and,
Doug.
Dinah Washington, What a Difference a Word Makes. Oh, what a difference a day makes.
What a difference a day makes.